From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Nicole Chung's parents saw her as their gift from God, their miracle, their daughter who was meant to be. They wanted to raise their adopted Korean-American daughter in a loving, colorblind family. But Chung was also growing up in a predominantly white Southern Oregon town. She didn't see other Asian Americans at school or around town, and so the questions began to bubble up. Who was she really? Where did she belong? Was her adoption really an act of divine providence, as her adopted parents wished it? Or were there other people, other connections that could fill the void created by the very existence of these questions? This hour on Point, love, identity, and family, the story of a transracial adoption. And you can join us. What's your story of transracial adoption as a child or a parent? What are the challenges that you face and how do you work through them? Join us anytime at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from New York is Nicole Chung. Her new memoir is All You Can Ever Know. And we have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
It's really great to have you. And just out of full disclosure, I want to start off by telling you that you're talking to a fellow native Oregonian. grew up there.
That's lovely.
For the entire first half of my life here. So a lot of what you write about Oregon, I'm quite familiar with. But I was wondering if you might actually give us a sense about your story by reading just a little bit from the beginning of the book, because it's very beautifully told, and I'd love to have listeners get a feel for it.
Thank you. This is just from the very beginning of the book. The story my mother told me about them was always the same. Your birth parents had just moved here from Korea. They thought they wouldn't be able to give you the life you deserved. It's the first story I can recall, one that would shape 100 others once I was old enough and brave enough to go looking. When I was still young, 3 or 4, I've been told, I would crawl into my mother's lap before asking to hear it. Her arms would have encircled me, solid and strong where I was slight, pale and freckled against my light brown skin. Sometimes in these half-imagined memories, I picture her in the dress she wore in our only family portrait from this era, lilac with flutter sleeves, an oddly delicate choice for my solid and sensible mother. At that age, a shiny black bowl cut and bangs would have framed my face, a stark contrast to the reddish-brown perm my mother had when I was young. I was no doubt growing out of toddler cuteness by then, but my mom thought I was beautiful. When you think of someone as your gift from God, maybe you can never see them as anything else.
That's Nicole Chung reading from her memoir, All You Can Ever Know. So, Nicole, tell us more about this story that your mother, your adoptive mother, told you. How important was that story to you?
So important. And, you know, it was consistent. It never varied. I don't remember the first time I heard it. I don't remember the first conversation we had about my adoption. It must have been when I was, you know, too young to remember. I think because it was a transracial adoption, there was absolutely no avoiding it. I would have had questions from a very young age. So, you know, I always knew I was adopted. And it was obviously never a secret or something anyone tried to hide. And I think I must have expressed at the very beginning some confusion or some sadness over the fact I'd been given up. And so I think in a way, this simple comforting story was my parents' answer for that. And, you know, I think they truly believed everything that they were saying about my birth parents, about how it wasn't a decision that they wanted to make. It was one they felt they had to make. I think that, you know, there were certainly a lot of facts about it that were true, but it really was sort of this bare bones story, at least as I initially heard it. And it would be years before I really thought to question or look deeper or consider whether it was really enough for me. But it brought me enormous comfort.
Well, so let me talk a little bit more about sort of those early years in your family, because, you know, as you mentioned, it's a transracial adoption, and so there wasn't any question that that you were an adopted child. But I was just wondering, just on a day-to-day basis growing up within your family, inside the home, I mean, how often did questions or conversations about racial differences come up?
Hardly ever within our family, within our house. I say this in the book, but I truly believe From my parents' perspective and from most of my adoptive family's perspective, my race truly did not matter. This is not to say I believe they were truly race blind, right? But I think that where I was concerned, it was just of so little importance compared to how much they wanted a child and how much they loved me. And I think, in a way, none of us were really prepared for what would happen once I stepped outside, you know, the safe family haven out into the world where, in fact, my race did matter a great deal and where it was very noticeable and commented on. But within my family, I really don't remember very many conversations about race or our differences at all, especially when I was young.
Yeah. But hearing you describe that your parents wanted so much to welcome a child into their lives that that it didn't matter what race that child was. I mean, to me, that makes total sense, right? I mean, that doesn't seem wrong to me.
No, I don't think that it's morally wrong. I think in a way we all could have been maybe better prepared for the reality, though, of what that transracial adoption would mean, like beyond the circle of our family. Because I was always going to go out into the world and meet people who'd have questions about my adoption or how my parents got me. I was going to face those questions on the playground, in the grocery store. And I remember it was really difficult at first learning how to navigate those conversations with people I knew and with total strangers. And then, of course, like once I got older and started facing more racism, like explicitly, I had no idea how to respond. I hadn't really been prepared for the possibility that it would happen. I didn't even really know what to call it. And so I think in that sense, too, like we could have been maybe gone into that, I guess, with eyes more open. But I want to stress this. I think at the time, my parents were really following advice they'd been given from other people, like social workers, the judge who finalized my adoption, the adoption attorney. My parents did ask about my race when they adopted me, and everyone assured them it was not really relevant and that they shouldn't worry about it. So in that sense, they were really just sort of following advice they believed came from experts.
Well, we'll talk more about that in a little later in the show, because it's an important point in terms of if and how the view on transracial adoption and how to manage these complexities, how that view has changed. So I do promise you we'll talk more about that in a moment. But I also just want to hear more from you right now about, you know, those early years growing up through, you know, the time you were 10, 12, 15, because you do write in the book that you sort of say that it wouldn't have mattered to us, meaning, you know, your adoptive parents, it wouldn't have mattered to us if you were black, white, or purple with polka dots, they would tell their daughter over and over once you were old enough to understand the story of how you came to them. And then you write, odd as that declaration would sound to me, every time I would always believe them. Now, why did it sound odd to you at the time?
I think it sounded odd for much of my childhood because I could see how much it mattered, like, to me and to others. You know, it didn't seem like something that we should ignore or something that could be pushed under the rug. I mean, at the same time, I believed them because, as I mentioned before, I think that their love for me and for our family was so strong. And again, going back to something you mentioned before in your introduction, they also really believed that this adoption was part of God's plan, like for them, for me, for our family. So it couldn't have worked out any other way. And I really believe they just felt so strongly that it was the right thing and was a good thing. And I could see the ways in which it was good, too. So it made sense to me in a way that my race didn't matter to them. I mean, it would be strange if your parents did, say, think about you differently or, you know, love you less because of how you looked, right? And so, you know, that part always made sense to me. I truly do believe, to this day, I don't think it really matters to people in my family. Maybe nor should it. But it is something I wish that we'd maybe had the language to talk more about when I was growing up.
Right. Because there's that tension, though, that I hear you saying that maybe it shouldn't to this day and matter to your family, and that's okay. But it matters to you, though.
Right. And, yeah. I mean, I think it should probably – it's probably too simplistic even to say it didn't matter to them at all. It didn't affect their feelings for me. It didn't affect how they saw our family or its legitimacy or, you know, its importance. But I think that – I think they truly believed if it didn't matter to them, then it shouldn't matter to others. And I think that's sort of where the tension enters in, because it did matter to others and it did matter to me.
Right. So can you tell me then a little bit more about outside the home as you grew older? What were one or two of the experiences that you encountered that really brought this, you know, the transracial nature of your family to front and center in your life?
I think there were a few different things. The first is what I mentioned before. I would get questions, and I guess most of them were probably very innocently meant, but at the time could feel very intrusive, especially from people we didn't know. You know, I remember people in the grocery store just stopping to ask, like, where did they get you? I remember someone once asking my parents in front of me, how much did you pay for her? And people would also just kind of come out and say surprising, sort of terrible things about how lucky I was to be raised here instead of wherever I would have been raised before. I'm trying to think. You know, and then other things that brought it to the forefront sort of fell into the camp of more obvious racism, like pulled back eyes at school and like sing song chants and actual racial slurs that started probably when I was in second or third grade. And so, you know, that obviously really brought this home for me in a different kind of way, because I started to encounter proof that my race was noticeable to other people, but in like cruel ways. And again, just didn't know how to talk to anybody about what was happening at the time.
Well, some of those, we just got a minute to go here before the break, but let me just ask you quickly, some of those incidents that you just described, your parents were there, right? They heard what some people were saying. I mean, how did they respond?
They never witnessed anybody calling me a slur. I think, they certainly would have said something.
But the how much did you pay for her comment? I mean, that's...
Yeah, my parents would tend to make jokes about it, I think, as a way of gently pointing out people shouldn't be asking. That was sort of their go-to strategy.
Well, we're talking with Nicole Chung. She's a writer and author, and her new memoir is entitled All You Can Ever Know. It's a story about her transracial adoption and her search for her identity within the story of her family. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Nicole Chung. Her new memoir is entitled All You Can Ever Know, and it's her story of her transracial adoption and her search for her identity and what difference it made to her when she actually sought out the truth of the story of her biological family. Nicole, in a minute, I do want to hear the story about how and when you decided to sort of find the answers to the questions that were bubbling up in your life. But there's just something, I'm trying to figure out the right way to say this, but I'm just trying to, I want to get a sense that you're not saying that you never felt unloved by your parents, right?
Oh, no, okay. I never felt unloved.
Okay.
Haven't.
Yeah. Because I think part of me is responding to your story as I'm a parent myself, not of adopted children, mind you. And I just feel like parents always try their best, right? They always do they try to do the best with what they have in their toolkit. And it sounds to me like, is what you're saying that your adoptive parents didn't quite have the toolkit that you needed them to have as a child of a different race?
I mean, thinking about this from their perspective, which I've tried to do a lot, partly because I'm a parent myself, and I really sympathize and I know how difficult it is. I have no illusions about like mistakes that I've made or just things I wish I had in my toolkit. But I think in a way, you know, they weren't especially well served by the advice they were given at the time either. I think, and they've expressed this to me, that they wish they had been offered more in the way of information, not like warning. I don't think they would have decided not to adopt transracially if they'd gotten more information. But at the time, that wasn't a conversation anybody was having with them. And I think they have, you know, real regrets about that just from their own perspective as well, because I think it was difficult for them later hearing that I had gone through some things that I didn't know how to talk with them about, that we didn't know how to talk about as a family, that maybe we all should have been, like, collectively better equipped to handle, you know? So it's not, like, a matter of, like, blame or, like, definitely not wishing that I hadn't been adopted or adopted by them. It's just more, we all wish that we'd gotten different information. And they really did try, to their credit, to seek it out at the time. You know, they asked many questions, just nobody really was telling them, these are some things maybe you should be aware of. These are some things you can expect. You should think about how you'll answer this question, or, you know, talk to your child about racism. You know, nobody was saying that to them. And it was really the job of the people they were talking to have those conversations, I think.
Okay. Now, so I can hear... And fully understand how the pain of the experiences that you were having, those racist experiences that you talked about, was something difficult enough to handle, or know what to do with, or how to come through that. But in addition to that, was there a longing that you had, just sort of internally, with racism aside, was there a longing or an emptiness or something that you felt that needed to be filled because of, you know, the fact that when you looked in the mirror, you didn't see the same features or complexion as you saw with your parents?
Yeah, I think it wasn't so much an emptiness or like I felt like something was missing. There were two parts of it. One was that I really did keenly feel, once I was old enough to notice and once I was old enough to have it pointed out to me, I did really feel those differences strongly. In a way, I got used to being like one of the few or one of the only like ones in the room or the school or the space I was in, but it was never really fully comfortable. I don't know. The closest I can come is like thinking about, It was sort of like when I left my hometown, I had a lot of great friendships and great relationships, and I love my family and all of that. But it really felt like sort of coming out of a cramped little space that wasn't quite big enough. Like I never really felt fully comfortable. And I don't think that was just the adoption. You know, I think a lot of that was just a function of where I grew up. And it was a predominantly white area. I went to like very white schools, especially my grade school. You know, so that was definitely like some discomfort. Yeah. And then the other part is I really did feel this curiosity, this longing to know more about my birth family. There was so little that we really knew for sure, especially as I got older and realized, you know, maybe some of this is guesswork. Maybe there are just things that I'm thinking or assuming are true that might not be. And can I live with never really knowing the actual answers?
So what made you finally decide to reach out to them or try to find them?
There's a lot of things. It's interesting because, as I write in the book, my pregnancy with my first child was a really strong push. Sometimes I think like I wouldn't have searched maybe if I hadn't become a parent, but other times I'm convinced that I would have eventually searched no matter what. You know, it's not something I have a firm answer to. I'd certainly been curious. I'd wondered. I had gotten a little bit of information that was available to me without making contact. The state of Washington, where I was adopted, you could petition basically for non-identifying, like, basic social history. No names, no addresses, but, like, general, very general information. I got that, and it was very, very little. But I had done that. I had done some research, and I knew sort of what a search would involve. But it was really my pregnancy that was the final push. I remember sitting at my first prenatal appointment, talking with the midwife, and she was asking me all these questions about my medical history, my family history, my mother's pregnancies and her births, and why I was born so prematurely, because I was born about 10 weeks early.
Yeah. And you said, I don't know.
Right. I had no answers. It was actually really scary to be facing my first pregnancy. You know, I knew nothing. And like, as an adoptee, I'm not saying all adoptees feel this way, but I felt so unprepared for pregnancy and labor and childbirth. It just, I don't know, something about knowing my mother, my adopted mother, had not gone through that with me. It was like my whole life began when I was adopted. I couldn't imagine stuff that came before. And I was excited to have a family, but I was really scared.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, I don't know. I felt like the story, it wasn't just about the health history, the medical information I didn't have that could be important. I felt all of a sudden like, I don't have enough to offer this child. You know, one day they'll grow up and they'll have questions about our family and our history. And like, what am I going to say? Mm-hmm. Is what I have good enough for them? Is it good enough for me anymore? And so that was really when I decided, okay, I'm going to go ahead. So I really began that process in my first trimester.
You know, I think every parent goes through that set of questions about, is what I have good enough for my child? And it can only, those questions only become far more acute when there's so many unanswered issues in the parents' life. So I hear you on that. Nicole, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, and I just want to get at least a couple of them here to be able to share their stories. So can you hang on for a second while I welcome some of our callers in?
Absolutely.
Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Eldred, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a story. I'm white. My first wife and I, we adopted two children of color, one when he was 6 weeks old and the other when he was 2 years old. And there was a year difference between them. So my story starts when they're like 4 years old and 3 years old. And they're all grown up now. They're 20 and 21. But one day we're walking through the Walmart parking lot, and just me and them, and I've got one by each hand. And kind of out of nowhere, the younger one, Jack, he says, no, I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous, I'm on the radio.
That's all right.
The older one, Isaac, he was about 4 years old, he says, Dad, he says, why are you white and we're black? And, you know, right then it's like, oh, goodness. Didn't think I'd have to have this conversation in the Walmart parking lot,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
what'd you do?
The story doesn't end. I go to answer him, and my younger son, Jack, who is lighter skinned, he stops. He stops right away. He's 3 years old. He stops. He rips his hand out of my hand, and he says, I'm not black. I'm white.
Huh.
And so now I turn to him. Because, oh my goodness, I hadn't thought about how they view themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the younger one, he was a mixture of, you know, African-American and Hispanic, and he was just lighter skinned.
Yeah.
And Isaac was African-American and Caucasian and was a little bit darker skinned.
Right.
And now my focus shifts, and I'm like, well, and before I get to answer, the older son looks across me to his brother and says, you're not white, you're black. You're black like me. And so now all this is going on in the span of, like, you know, 20 seconds. And, you know, I copped out and I said, well, you know, I think that's just how God wanted it. This is what our family is, and we all love each other, and I'm the dad, and you're my boys, and you know, I think it was good enough for him right then.
Jim, can I just ask you a quick follow-up question? I mean,
yeah.
I can't imagine how hard that was. Like you said, you didn't expect to have to confront that in the Walmart parking lot. But
that's right, exactly.
But I'm just wondering, after that, what did you do after that? Because it was all out in the open. You said it was the first time that you had to think about how they saw each other and themselves. How did it change how you were a father to them?
Well, I don't think it much changed.
Okay.
I've just been always aware of those issues, and if there was problems in school. We live in a real rural area, and there's been a lot of people in the community who've been very supportive, and my children were accepted. But, you know, it was also an area where there is kind of a fair amount of racism, and that's kind of when it would be dealt with, when some... you know, there was another incident when they got a little older, maybe first or second grade, where, you know, another student on the bus was calling them names. And,
yeah.
You know, you can think of the worst names you can be called. And, you know, we went to the principal of the elementary school. We talked about it, you know, and eventually it was dealt with. But I've kind of been just, like, always highly aware of these issues. And like I say, now they're grown. You know, one thing, and I hate to say this because it seems stereotypical, but my children of color, you know, and my older son,
mm-hmm.
you know, you'd look at him and say you'd say he's black, you know, and both of them have always been good at sports, and sports is really, being good at sports has helped them be more accepted in the community. It is a stereotype, and I wish there were other reasons, but that's one thing that did help them.
Well, you know? Jim, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your story and for your call as well. Nicole, I think the thing that stays with me most from what Jim said is that he hadn't before that moment in the Walmart parking lot, he hadn't maybe actively thought about how his adopted sons saw each other and themselves, and that was the moment that opened his eyes.
I think a lot of times people are surprised by how young children really do notice lots of differences, not just racial differences. I remember it was something I was reading a lot about before I became a parent, because I was just, given my own experience and the fact that I'd never been a parent before, my response is always like, I'm going to read a whole lot about this topic. I was trying to figure out like when and how I should bring it up, because I knew I should bring it up. I shouldn't necessarily wait for them to have, you know, either bad experiences or like a lot of confusion. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was surprised to hear, like, you know, very, very young children, like as young as toddler age, sometimes pre-verbal, like they have indicated, they can indicate that they recognize these differences. So, I do think those conversations, it's great if you can start them young. And I also completely understand being kind of blindsided by them, because my kids are in school, and I think one of the prevailing messages, even at their school, and it's extremely diverse, and you know, and there are a lot of kids of color and like children of immigrants there, and I don't know that they're really talking about mm-hmm. these things at school explicitly. I think they're assuming, maybe because there's so much diversity,
that they, like, don't have to,
right? Like, yeah. It's built in acceptance and tolerance. When, I mean, we know that's not entirely true,
right.
And I have heard stories from my older child about things happening at the school. I don't know. It's probably just a conversation we all need to do better at,
yeah.
or think more about,
yeah.
you know? So,
Nicole, hang in here for just a second, because I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Joyce McGuire-Pavo joins us now. She's a licensed clinical social worker and a family therapist. She's also a lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the founder of the Center for Family Connections, a nonprofit that served children in blended families for more than 30 years. Joyce McGuire-Pavo, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
So Nicole has brought up really interesting line of questioning here through her story. And you heard her say earlier that she just didn't feel like her adoptive parents were well equipped to engage with these questions about the questions that rise with the transracial adoption. And this is, Nicole, this was in the 80s, right?
Yes, I was born in 1981.
Yeah. So, I mean, how much has that changed since then, Joyce? Is this...
Well, it really, what's happened is there has been change all along, but it doesn't reach everyone. And there were wonderful programs happening in the 80s, and I've been doing this work for 40 years. But the problem is that it doesn't reach as many people. Nowadays, it can, because of the internet and because of more connectiveness.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, in the early 80s in rural Oregon, that might have been one of the places that it didn't reach.
Absolutely. And there wasn't a good voice of adopted people. Many of the people working in this field were adopted parents. So they had wonderful insights, but they weren't the voice of the adopted.
Children.
And so I was one of the early pioneers to do that. And I think it makes a big difference to really understand the experiential issues that are, you know, very different, because everyone's story is a case study of one. And there mm-hmm. are so many different kinds of adoptions. But it's very important to, first of all, understand the loss and trauma that's a part of any adoption. And then the next thing is, if it's a transracial adoption or international adoption, there are added things that people need to know. Today, we're very lucky because the transracially adopted people have grown into the roles of being the teachers. And you can really hear the voices. You can hear, you know, Nicole's voice in her book, but then there are many excellent therapists and psychologists who are doing work in research and in clinical work
right.
who are themselves.
Well, so doesn't a lot of sort of how a family engages with this, it matters a lot in terms of what the child, him or herself, wants, right? Because I imagine there's a big spectrum of some children as they grow older maybe really want to be connected strongly to their cultural heritage, or perhaps, you know, even their biological families, and maybe others aren't so. It isn't so much of a priority for them. So, like, how do you navigate all
well,
that?
Well, what many of us believe is that children should be prepared to be adults. And that's one of our jobs as parents, to prepare them. So if understanding your culture, your race, your ethnicity is part of that, then it needs to happen all along. It's, if your child was a great musician, you wouldn't keep lessons back from them. This is part of their developing identity, and it's really important to share with them as much as possible about the reality of their background. And that's done in different ways and in different pacing for different people. You're absolutely right. but it's the job of the adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're hearing from Joyce McGuire-Pavo. She's a licensed clinical social worker and a family therapist. And also, of course, from Nicole Chung. Her new memoir is All You Can Ever Know. It's her story of her transracial adoption. And Nicole, when we come back, I want to hear from you about what happened when you decided to reach out to your biological family. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Nicole Chung. Her new memoir is All You Can Ever Know. It's her story of her transracial adoption. And joining us as well is Joyce McGuire-Pavo. She is the founder of the Center for Family Connections, a nonprofit that served children in blended families for more than 30 years. Now, Nicole, I wonder if you could just briefly tell us what happened when you finally were reconnected with your biological family, because I imagine that growing up, there's a very understandable tendency to idealize right. These people that you don't know. Was that ideal wasn't fully realized?
I mean, it's always dangerous idealizing people you've never met, right? In a lot of ways, it really was sort of a confirmation of the story I'd gotten as a child, but much deeper and richer and more complicated. And it was interesting, I hadn't thought enough, honestly, about my birth parents' perspective and what it must have been like what factors could have led to the adoption. That was something I guess I wondered about in a way as a kid, but I didn't have the maybe emotional maturity or knowledge of the world to really consider what they might have gone through. I was not expecting to find, a story that had so much like trauma, really, and loss that had nothing to do with my adoption. Things that were just difficult that they were dealing with that, might have been factors in the adoption, certainly, but weren't like directly caused by it, for example. So when I first reached out to them, I did so via a confidential intermediary under Washington state law. At the time I was placed and then at the time I searched, I had to go through a third party. Mm-hmm. So that person forwarded a letter from me. And before we could exchange any identifying information, like things like last names and addresses and really specifics about our lives, we had to get various forms completed and it had to be by mutual consent. So that also made the process take a little bit longer. But I reached out through the intermediary, and my birth parents, at the time I found them, had been divorced for many years, so I wrote to them separately. And so it was like two different reunions, really, with two different branches of the family instead of the one. And like naively, I had always pictured like talking with and meeting them or reconnecting with them at least like together. So that was interesting. That was my first sort of surprise. And what I found initially was that they had never told my sisters, my biological sisters. I have a half sister and a full sister, and they were living at home at the time I was placed, and they'd never been told about the adoption. They'd been told I died at birth. Right. When I wrote to my birth parents, due to, I think, the language barrier, just some difficulty translating the letter, that was sort of how my sisters got involved and how they found out. And it was definitely a shock for them. As little as I knew, they knew even less than I did. And so it was really, it was a whole family sort of reconnection. But as I mentioned, segmented into like different branches. It was unexpected.
So Joyce, adoptions are so complicated, right? Because you're dealing with the lives, the lives of so many people at the most vulnerable point probably in their lives. So in hearing Nicole say that that her biological parents hadn't even told their other children. I mean, how do you would I don't know how is that unusual or
no,
not?
No, it really isn't. I mean, there's a lot of shame and guilt and, you know, really deep emotions. And although no one in adoption gets enough support and help and training and treatment, birth parents get the least. And they just leave and have to figure it out themselves. And often there is a history of more loss and trauma in their lives. And as Nicole said, sometimes it's not related directly to the adoption. It was something that was going on anyway. Yeah. So this isn't a surprise. And how do you tell your other children that one of them is gone and why? So there's, you know, and also there's the cultural issues. I mean, yeah. this family was an immigrant family, and so it's not something they usually do, place children for adoption in their situation. So I think there are so many pieces to this that are familiar and difficult. And again, every story is a case study of one. This is not every story about every birth parent, but it's Nicole's family story.
Yeah. And Nicole, so then as you began to form relationships, I mean, especially with one of your sisters. Mm-hmm. Did, you know, you in the book, the question that keeps coming up in my mind is, did that process then help, you know, fill those gaps that you said you had been feeling growing up with your adopted family? Did it get you to the place that you were hoping to go to?
I think the primary gaps I was aware of at the time I searched were just simply kind of gaps in knowledge, yeah. which is not to minimize maybe emotional or other, you know, other factors. I certainly cared about I cared about my adoption. I was curious about my birth family. There was a lot I wanted to know and questions I would have loved to have the opportunity to ask, which is one of the reasons I searched. But I think it was really from my sisters, especially my full sister, Cindy, from whom I got a lot of information. You know, she was very shocked and she had a lot of questions. And so I think that she was even more determined than I was in a way to get the truth. I didn't always feel I wasn't really part of this family. I didn't feel it was my place to come in and demand all of these answers all of a sudden. I kept my asks pretty simple at first. It was like, please fill out a medical history. And if I could ask you some questions, I would like to. But if you don't want to be in contact, I understand. And I will respect that. So, but Cindy was, this is her family, the only one she's got. And I think she was very surprised and wanted to know more. And so she was really pushing for answers. And that was how I began to learn more and fill in those gaps in knowledge.
Yeah. Well, this is obviously an issue that has had an impact on many people's lives because we've got a stack of callers and I just want to let them have their say a little bit more here. So let's go to John, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was raised in the South in the 60s and 70s and adopted 15 years ago, a beautiful young man from Guatemala. And my question is I don't have any experience. How do I prepare my son for living in a racial world?
Oh, because you yourself have never faced or experienced racism, John?
Yeah, I had, you know, lived an upper middle class life, went in the military where there's very little racism, and, you know, I've just not faced those issues.
Yeah.
How do I prepare my son to go out into the world? You know, he's very dark. He's, you know, going to face these things. I don't know what to tell him.
Joyce, do you have an answer for John?
Well, you know, that's a huge question. But one of the answers is to make sure you surround yourself with people of color, especially, you know, if he's African-American. You know, make sure that if you're choosing pediatricians or dentists, that you look for role models for him and that you look for help for you. You know, the best people to help you to understand how to deal with racism are people who have experienced it. And so, and it's also good for him to see you claiming these people who are like him and not just him.
Yeah. Let's go to Dana, who's calling from Glen Falls, New York. Dana, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm the white parent of two Asian daughters, Asian American now. We began our adoption process about 28 years ago, and I feel really grateful that we had the agency we did. I had I had no knowledge of how to do this when we started, but one of the requirements of our agency was that we attend numerous workshops throughout the process, and a few of them involved adult adoptees who were people of color adopted by white parents who shared their stories, which in many cases were not so good,
mm-hmm.
and made clear to us how important it was, for one thing, not, you know, to the extent we could, don't live in a segregated white community, live in a place where our kids would grow up mm-hmm. In a more multiracial environment.
Yeah.
So it sounds also. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, Dana, that it sounds like because you were able to take those classes and connect with that community, it really helped, and specifically, it helped your daughters.
I would say that it did. You know, they're as they grew up. Our oldest daughter, I mean, she just sort of noticed at one point that when I sit down at the table in the cafeteria at lunchtime, I've just noticed that most of my friends are Asian, and that's just the way she gravitated, and I think that made it. We also incorporated, I mean, we always celebrate Chinese New Year. For a while, we celebrated Thai New Year, which was our other daughter's yeah. culture, until she said, you know, I'm not interested in this anymore. But to this day, Chinese New Year is you know, as big a holiday for our family as Thanksgiving.
Well, Dana, I just want to say thank you for your call, because that makes me think of a question I want to turn to Nicole. Nicole, now that you're a parent, how much does your Korean heritage, Korean culture, how much does that factor into how you're raising your child?
You know, having grown up outside a Korean family and outside a Korean-American community, I think I will always feel like a little bit insecure. Maybe that's not the right word, but I think I will always feel that separation a little bit and yeah, some inadequacy where that's concerned. I've tried with sort of little things that I've recovered. You know, my older daughter and I I've taken some Korean lessons, and we've studied the language together a little bit. Certainly through my sister and our relationship, I've found access to more things. It's definitely something that I talk about a lot with my kids. But I think I will always, to be really frank, just feel like not especially well equipped to pass things on. And, you know, just this is just my own experience. I don't want to presume to speak for other adoptees who do reconnect with their birth families or culture. But it took a long time for me to get over the feeling that I was reaching for something I didn't have a right to, almost like it felt sometimes like appropriation, even though it really wasn't. It was awkward. I sometimes still feel uncomfortable in those spaces, and trying to figure out my place is a little bit difficult. It's still worth it to me to try and to try to pass things on. But I think I'll always wish I had a little bit more.
Joyce, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, there are a couple of things I wanted to say. One is that for all adoptees, not just transracial, when you get reconnected with your birth family, what you learn is that you belong in both families and you belong in neither. There are ways that you have a place, a very strong place in your adoptive family where all your memories are and where you grew up. But you have this slight feeling that you're not quite like them. And then you find your birth family and you feel more like them in some ways, but you don't belong and there's no history. So it's a complicated thing. The other thing is that Nicole mentioned the birth of her first child being the time when she really thought about doing something. And that's not uncommon. When you grow up in a closed adoption, you don't know another human being in the world related to you.
Right.
Think about that. It's huge.
Biologically related to you. Yeah,
who's
yeah.
genetically, biologically yeah. related to you. And so the only two ways to fix that are to have a baby or to find your birth family. And so Nicole did both. And I think that's, you know, it's an important human factor.
Yeah. Nicole, I just want to ask a quick question before we run out of too much time, because mm-hmm. I wonder, how did the process or what impact did writing this book have on the relationship that you have with your adoptive parents? Because I understand that your adoptive father, he passed away.
Yes, my father passed away in January as I was finishing up this book. So he had read a lot of it, but he didn't get to finish it, unfortunately. And it's been difficult. I mean, it's just a difficult thing to lose a parent, regardless whether yeah. you're adopted or not, right? And then having it all happen at the same time as this book. There are still parts of the book that are really hard for me to read. parts that he's in, but also I'm grateful in a way that I think his love for me is very clear and sort of memorialized in a way in this book, and that'll always be special to me. Before he died, he told me he loved the book. He was really happy that one of his goofy jokes stayed in it. That was like his top priority. And I think they were both like surprised by how it was written. My mother kept saying it reads a lot like a novel, you know, but it's the truth. I'm not sure what she was expecting. But they gave me the great gift of reading it really openly and generously and saying, this is your life and it's your perspective on our family. It's not maybe the book that we would have written about our family, but that's okay. And I think they were very proud and, you know, to a degree feel, you know, I think they feel honored in a way by their portrayal in the book, just because I think their love for me is one of the clearest themes throughout. You know, I tried to be very honest about things that were difficult, but also it's just the truth that they love me very much and that overall I had a good childhood. And they, I think it was special for them to get to read my memories about that.
Yeah. You know, we've just got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left here to go. And there's so much more that we could discuss, right? Because this is such a major huge issue in deeply in so many people's lives. But Joyce, I guess I'm wondering in the last minute that we have here, for people listening here who are right now, you know, grappling with these questions, and perhaps they didn't get the support they initially needed when they were parents who adopted a child, for example, like, where would you recommend they turn, or how, what next steps should they take?
Well, it's never too late. And, you know, it's really important to do whatever you can to educate yourself about everything related to adoption and everything related to race, if it's a transracial adoption, to really be aware. And the first place people go is often back to the agency, and that may or may not be helpful to them because they have a certain role and they may have people who aren't as well trained. You know, there are so many wonderful resources. I can give you some kind of a list that you could put up on your website or something.
We'll try to do that.
Rather than just
But there are places that people can
absolutely
go.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And Nicole, I mean, I imagine that you've heard from a lot of folks, perhaps adoptees themselves.
A lot, yes.
Yeah. And what have they been telling you?
It's been really wonderful to hear responses from adoptees. I get anywhere from 5 to 10 messages a day, and it's been really wonderful and overwhelming. So that's just been incredible to me. Some people telling me this is the first time, of course it's my experience alone, but people telling me it's the first time they felt anything like their life represented in literature. I wish it wasn't, but just adding on to what Joyce said about resources for families, I mean, I think it's so important to seek out and listen to adoptees, mm-hmm. and there are so many of us writing and trying to tell our stories.
Yeah.
So really seeking those out and listening, even when it's challenging, I think is so important.
Yeah. Well, Nicole Chung's new memoir is called All You Can Ever Know. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Nicole, thank you so very much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Joyce McGuire-Pavo, founder of the Center for Family Connections, a nonprofit that's been serving children in blended families for more than 30 years. Thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.